All right, thanks everyone for joining. I think we'll just give folks another minute or two to sign into the Zoom platform and then we'll get started. All right. Well, it's about a minute after the hour, so maybe we'll go ahead and kick this off because we got a lot of rich content for you today. So we're joined once again by Cindy Brack, a senior healthcare researcher with ARC, who you may recall a couple months ago give a great talk on the tools that ARC has made available to help hospitals as they, look to improve their own processes around around consent and informed consent, and relating those back to Leapfrog's, new optional section on the 2022 survey that we hope to begin to add to and build on the 2023 survey. And today, on really a closely related note, Cindy's going to talk to us a little bit about health literacy, defining the term as much as sort of explaining what it is in its own right, but then relating it back also to those informed consent discussions. So we think that's a really important, really sort of part and parcel of what we're hoping to accomplish at Leapfrog with the new informed consent standard, right? And then our new measures around health equity and so on. It's all sort of a related push, and health literacy ties a lot of those subjects together. And I think I've learned a lot just in talking to Cindy, and I hope this will be really helpful for you all as we as we move forward with this question set and hopefully working towards a new standard. So with that, I'll turn it over to Cindy. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jean-Luc. It's really great to be back with you all, and I'm just going to get into presenter mode. And can you tell me, Jean-Luc, are you seeing my slide in that presenter mode?
Yeah, we can see the slide.
Just the slide. Great. Well, I was supposed to be co-presenting today with my colleague Maya Gerstein. Unfortunately, she's unable to join me, so I'm afraid I'm a solo act today. If you joined us last time I spoke, it will be a very different presentation, but I am still employed by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, so you shouldn't take what I'm about to say to be any official position of ARC or the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And for those of you who aren't familiar with ARC, our work falls into mainly three buckets. We invest in research to understand how to make healthcare safer and improve quality. We create materials to teach and train healthcare professionals and systems to improve care for their patients. And we generate measures and data to track performance and to improve it and evaluate the progress of the U.S. healthcare system. So last time I started with a story about my father and informed consent. And this time I have a new story, new that I just learned it since the last time I presented, about my mother. My mother at age 90 was having some heart symptoms and went to the emergency department. And she sat there waiting in the ED as one is wont to do. And after some time, she was put on a gurney and an orderly started wheeling her down the hall. Now, she had not been examined. She had not spoken to a clinician. And so she asked the orderly, you know, where are you taking me? And he said, oh, I'm taking you to get an echocardiogram. And nobody had talked to my mother about getting an echocardiogram. And she said, you know, said that to the orderly, but he just kept pushing her down the hall. And so my mother, who, you know, has me as a daughter, sat up on the gurney near a place where some healthcare staff members were standing and said in a loud voice so that everyone can hear, I have not consented. And that got people's attention, and she was wheeled back to the ED, and she thought somebody would come and talk to her about this procedure, that they, this test that they wanted to do. But it wasn't until the attending physician was going over discharge that he said, oh, you didn't have an echocardiogram, and you know, was very unhappy about that. But at that point, she was, you know, ready to leave, was not having any of it. And so that's just a little story about, you know, how leapfrog standards might come in handy about defining what kinds of things require consent and making sure that it actually does happen before you start wheeling patients off to have procedures and diagnostic tests. So today I'm going to be talking a little bit about health literacy, what it is, why it's important, some strategies for the informed consent discussion, and also creating easy to understand consent forms and educational materials. And you'll see that this really maps very closely to LeapFrog standards. But just, you know, starting us off all on the same page, I'd love for you to tell me which of these you think is an example of health literacy? It could be any or all of the above. And just chat it in, and I will see if I can get the chat on my screen, which may not be able to happen. Let's see. Yes, I think I can. So, you know, choose A, when people can read and understand health information, and or B, when people can act on health information, when organizations make sure people can find the health information they need, and when organizations ensure that people are equitably access and use health services. And I'm not seeing anything in the chat, so you must all be thinking about it very carefully. People are maybe putting it in the Q&A. Let me see. I'm getting, yes, 1D. The chat is disabled. I'm so sorry. Put it in the Q&A. So I have one vote for D. Anybody else? D. Come on, guys, chat it in. This is a journey. D. All right, so we have D's. Why? I don't see anything. So this is, do you not see? Technical people see if there's a problem with actually viewing the screen. The only thing, if it's not a formal polling question, so you're just seeing the slide and chatting or putting in the Q&A what you think the answer is. Knowing what your doctor is saying in lay terms. Yes, there is no formal poll. That's why we're using the Q&A. Now somebody says no slide. We are on slide one. We should be on slide seven. Jean-Luc, are you seeing the polling question slide?
No, sorry, I am also seeing slide one here.
All right. This is bizarre. I'm going to stop sharing. And we will try again. Share screen. Actually, get out of that mode. And apologies, technical problems invariably happen. So I'm going to start off with that. Okay, so now I'm guessing you see it, but not in slideshare mode. I'm going to need to move one of these Zoom things around. Okay, and now I need to stop. All right, so I'm assuming you're seeing slide 7 now. Is that correct?
Yeah, you got the right slide.
Now, let's see if it advances, though. Are you seeing what is health literacy slide?
Yep, with the answer all of the above.
Yay, and that is indeed the answer. So a little bit of a trick question there, but health literacy is about people being able to find, understand, and use health information to inform health-related decisions and actions for themselves and others. And that depends on two things. It depends on personal health literacy, which is what my skills are. And it also depends on organizational health literacy, how easy or complicated we make it in order to be able to find and understand and use that information. So those two together is what produces health literacy. And that's why all of the above was the right answer. Now, the word health literacy and health literacy often makes people think this is all about, you know, reading and math. And that is a component of it. And the fact is that many people struggle with reading and math. These are data from a national survey, or actually international survey, but US data about working aged adults. So not even including the elderly who have lower rates of literacy and numeracy. And we see that 1 in 5 adults have low literacy and 1 in 3 have low numeracy. So clearly a lot of American adults are facing challenges in that area. But health literacy is not just about reading and math. You know, yes, we want people to understand written communication and numbers, but we also want understanding and spoken communication. We want people to be able to navigate around the healthcare system and get where they need to go and to use that information to act on it. Now, you know, why is it important? Well, people need to be able to find, understand, and use information to get and stay healthy. So, you know, in terms of informed consent, you need to understand your condition, know your what your options are, assess the risks and benefits, choose what makes sense for you, and know when and how to follow up. So what happens if you don't address health literacy? And this time, this is not a personal story. This is a very well-known story of a woman named Toni Cordell, who had women's problems. And she was told by her doctor, they could fix her right up. And when she went in to sign all the forms to the hospital, she was embarrassed to let them know that she did not read well and she could not read them all. And so she just signed, you know, at the dotted line where they told her to. And it wasn't until after she had the surgery that she realized that she had a hysterectomy. And she said, how could I be so stupid as to have let a part of my body be removed and not know about it? And while this is, happened a long time ago, I have heard many more recent examples of similar situations where people are getting procedures or testing or whatever without knowing really what was going to be done to them. And the fact is, this is happening because organizational health literacy in the United States is low. So what does that mean for informed consent? Well, you know, the informed consent forms are routinely written at a level that the majority of adults don't understand. And I'm not just talking about that, 20% who have literacy. you got to remember that when you target, let's say, an average of the eighth or ninth grade level, reading level for a document, that means that half of people are not going to be able to understand that easily. Another shortcoming in organizational health literacy is that clinicians frequently don't check patients' understanding when asking for informed consent. And when communicating risks, clinicians may use statistics that are hard to understand. And, you know, it's not just people who have low personal health literacy, because anyone can experience low personal health literacy. It's dynamic. You know, I can tell you many stories of when I've been tired or frightened or overwhelmed or under time pressure. And, you know, I'm just not able to process information, act on information the way I might otherwise. So that's why at ARC, we advocate using health literacy universal precautions. And this is the same thing as blood safety. You know, you don't know whose blood is infected, so you treat everyone's blood as if it might be infected. And that's what we want to do with health literacy. We want to structure health information and the delivery of care as if everyone may have limited health literacy. You know, you can't tell by looking who's understanding and who isn't. And just because somebody has high literacy skills doesn't mean they're understanding. I like to say that health literacy is a state, not a trait. And the good news is that everyone benefits from clear communication. I also want to make the point that health literacy is critical to achieving health equity. Health literacy strategies are integral to delivering culturally and linguistically appropriate services, improve cross-cultural communication, and have the potential to reduce disparities, because minority adults are more likely to have low personal health literacy. So I'll come back to this theme in a little bit, but let's get down to some specific strategies. Because we all think we're being clear. Nobody says something, you know, without thinking that they have communicated effectively. But sometimes that's an illusion. So first step is to prepare the workforce to be health literate. And you can start with hiring diverse staff, including people who have health literacy expertise, and then setting and meeting goals for teaching all staff health literacy and informed consent strategies. So you can integrate it into orientations or other existing trainings that you hold. You can take advantage of free online training. And then you need to track your progress to make sure that you're meeting those goals. And that syncs very well with the LeapFrog standard around informed consent. And, you know, have to put in a plug for ARC's own products. So I mentioned it last time I spoke. We have two training modules, the ARC Making Informed Consent and Informed Choice module for leaders and for healthcare professionals. And if you're affiliated with the Joint Commission, you can take it for free continuing education credit on the Joint Commission's learning management system. If you're not connected with the Joint Commission or you want to have it on your own learning management system so you can track completion in your organization, you can ask ARC for the modules and you can put them on your own system. So I want to talk about some of these strategies for improving spoken communication, because that is really the heart of informed consent, is the discussion. And on the right-hand side, you see some tools that can help you with implementing spoken communication improvements and you know, self-assessment tools and observation, patient feedback. So some resources specifically on TeachBack, which I promised last time I spoke I would delve into more today, and I will. So let me go through some of these things. first, and this is a slide from the training module, but first thing, which I kind of call the duh of health literacy and clear communication is, you know, if somebody does not speak English proficiently, by which I mean very well, not just okay, then you need to provide language assistance. And so in the training modules, we talk about how to, you know, identify, gather that data of limited English proficiency, inform patients they have a right to a free interpreter, and goes over the different kinds of high quality language assistance. So using staff that have been certified as bilingual, bilingual staff that have been trained as interpreters, as well as qualified medical interpreters. So we also have another training tool called Team Steps Limited English Proficiency Module. And this training module is about incorporating the interpreter as part of your team. And one of the things that they teach in this module is about creating psychological safety. You know, interpreters generally will kind of stay in their lane. You know, I will say what you said in the patient's language. And so you really need to give them permission to speak up and to let you know if they think the patient doesn't understand something. So there's a whole module on working effectively with interpreters. because often people try to get by with either, you know, sketchy English skills or, you know, my old high school Spanish. And we know that creates patient safety risk. So making sure that you are protecting your hospital and yourself from things going wrong because of miscommunication is one of the key messages of working with calling for and working with interpreters. And so I sort of kind of loop back to the idea about health equity. And just we need to recognize that we all make assumptions. We tend to think that people, you know, think like we do, you know things that we know. And the fact is that people from different cultural backgrounds, you know, may not be familiar with medical concepts like contagion and titration, or Western medicine. They may have different health beliefs, religious beliefs. They have different health practices, diets, what supplements, you know, herbal remedies that they take. And so it's important that, you know, we check our assumptions by asking. And there are some tools around for trying to be more culturally sensitive. But I'm going to move on now to plain language, which is a big health literacy piece. And, you know, we know that using jargon is a no-no. And the thing is that we've been, you know, trained to use jargon, and it's our shorthand or our, you know, how we talk with other professionals. But we forget that there are perfectly good words that mean the same thing and that are likely to be understood. So, you know, these are just some examples of substitutions that you can make. And, you know, it's not just medical language. We want to use common language that we use every day in our living room, you know, with your uncle. Though even if people might understand the words on the right, utilize sufficient beneficial, exacerbate, it takes more energy to kind of follow along. And it's all about making it easy so that they can pay attention to the important information that you're giving them. Now, I went over some you know, startling figures of a third of the adult population having numeracy challenges. And so it's so important to make numbers easy. And it is also really, really hard. So this is something that I think, you know, is one of those continual struggles that you'll always want to be improving on. First piece of advice, though, is don't be vague. You know, you might say rare, you might say likely. You know, what you think is likely might be 30%, and what I think is you're saying is 80%. So, you know, put a number on it. And it's better if you give numbers in terms of frequencies rather than decimals and percentages. You know, we sort of think, oh, everybody understands percentages, but the research shows actually people really are challenged by that. And so, you know, again, trying to keep the information consistent, so not changing up all the denominators and the time frames and stuff when you're asking people to make, you know, comparisons in their choices. Giving absolute risk instead of relative risk, and making sure, you know, you try and check your subconscious bias. You know, give this information both in the positive terms and in the negative terms. And finally, don't make the patients do math. Calculate it for them. You can also ask yourself, would a visual help patient and family understand better? So, you know, on the right-hand side is an icon array, very commonly used, but don't assume that it's self-explanatory. These are aids to augment to you use when you're having your discussion rather than just giving it to a patient to look at. On the left-hand side, it's trying to communicate a very small risk. So this is a 0.08% of the risk. So if you take 1 of 100, which is one of those squares on the top, and then you divide that square into 100, it's even less than one of those. So, you know, not every visual is going to be helpful. So testing with patients is also really helpful. So one of the LeapFrog standards is about using high quality decision aids. And so decision aids are tools to communicate unbiased information about options, benefits, harms, and risks. And good ones help patients and family figure out what matters most to them. So it elicits some of their preferences about what's important. And they can come in many different forms. They are paper, audiovisual, web-based, interactive. And, you know, why you might want to use them is they can help you structure the conversation. So, you know, people have thought through, you know, what is a good flow of information. It can improve patients' understanding of their options and help them weigh their choices. And prepares patients to come up with outcomes, including adverse ones. So lots of good reasons to use decision aids, but not all decision aids are created equal, and bad decision aids are worse than no decision aid at all. So, you know, you want to make sure that it comes from a reliable source, it's complete, including, you know, an option of no treatment or no testing. It's based on scientific evidence, it's unbiased, it's understandable, and helps patients to clarify their goals and values. So a number of the LeapFrog standards talk about providing the opportunity to ask questions. And as I told Jean-Luc, I think it needs to go further, because providing an opportunity, you know, even if you ask, do you have any questions? Generally, people are going to say no. They think you don't have time. They, you know, haven't really digested it. You need to really set an expectation that you are expecting questions. So even just asking, what questions do you have, rather than do you have any questions, says, okay, you know, this is it. I know you have questions. What questions do you have? Even a little better might be, oh, you know, this treatment may be new to you, and I expect that you have some questions. What would you like to know more about? And then, really important is also your body language. You know, sit at their eye level, look, listen, show them that you have the time, that you really do want to hear their questions. And now, as promised, we deeper dive into the teach back method. So if you were on my last webinar with LeapFrog, I did go over this graphic, and I'll do that again, and then we'll push it a little further. So teach back is a way of confirming that somebody is understanding what you're saying to them. You don't want to wait until you've given them a huge amount of information before you check their understanding. So you chunk out the information and then teach it. And then you ask them to teach back in their own words. And it's not a test. They can consult materials, but you have to make sure that they're not reading back an answer or they're not parroting an answer. If they say exactly what you said, they may just be kind of replaying the tape. They may not have really taken it in. So they need to explain in their own words. And if they've done that correctly, then go on and teach them the next piece or talk to them about the next issue. If they can't teach it back correctly, then you've got to reteach. And you have to reteach using different words, because if you say exactly the same thing, they're going to have exactly the same response, which is, I don't understand. So using a different approach, reteach it, and then you have to ask for the teach back again. You know, ask them to describe to you what it is they understood. And you have to keep that circle going until they do understand. Now, this is not, you know, we don't want patients to feel and families to feel like we're testing them. This is not a necessarily natural thing. It takes practice. And in our informed, making informed consent and informed choice modules, we give a bunch of examples of how you might get started, you know, initiating the teach back. It's just kind of getting into the rhythm of it. So you might say, well, just to make sure I explain things well, can you tell me in your own words what will happen if you choose to have this procedure? And then you might say, it's my job to make sure I explain things clearly. To make sure that I did, can you please tell me in your own words what good results you expect from this treatment? How likely is it that you think you'll get those results? Is there any downside to this treatment? And you can prompt them, you know, do you expect to experience any pain? For how long? Will you be limited in your activities? For how long? You know, really making sure that they understand it. And every treatment has some risks. Can you tell me in your own words what the risks of this procedure are? And, you know, further prompting if you don't get the responses that you wanted. You know, what about possible side effects we discussed? What could go wrong in surgery? Remember when we talked about allergic reactions, you know, and then see if that triggers their memory or you need to reteach. We talked about some other treatments you could choose. Can you tell me what some of the pros and cons of these alternate treatments are? What if you choose not to get any treatment? Can you tell me in your own words what might happen? And then reteaching and rechecking. Let's talk again about your choices, because I think I may not have explained it clearly. And then, so how would you describe your alternatives to having this diagnostic test? And the important thing to remember is, and if people cannot teach back correctly, they cannot give informed consent. So I'm going to move on to forms and educational materials. And starting with the writing process and, you know, including sort of all the stakeholders, clinicians, patients and families, lawyers, plain language experts. Those are the people that you want to have in part of this process. And then, you know, there are some writing guides and sample forms that you can use. On the right-hand side, that CMS Toolkit for Making Written Material Clear and Effective is a terrific writing guide. The other two resources called the PMAT and the CCI, in short, are both assessment tools that can help you check how understandable the information is. But the best test is to pilot test with diverse patients before you roll out the forms. So now I am going to play you a short, under 3 minutes video. And I'm going to let's see if this is going to work for me. Jean-Luc, you seeing it and hearing it?
How to use plain language on a government website. Too often, dense writing, confusing acronyms, and fancy jargon bog down government websites. Here's how to use plain language to help your customers find what they're looking for and save your agency time and money. You will need an understanding of your audience, a willingness to write clearly, plain language training resources, and a plain language checklist. Step 1. Know who your readers are and only include information that's relevant to them. Tailor your writing to the people with the least expertise. Get a plain language checklist at plainlanguage.gov. Step 2. Keep it simple. Fancy words often confuse more than impress, especially on the web. Choose words that are concrete, familiar, and easy to understand. Avoid jargon and legalese. Whenever possible, use pronouns like we and you, and eliminate acronyms most readers won't understand. Cut every unnecessary word. Extra words bury important information and make it hard for search engines to find the most relevant material. Step 3. Write in an easy-to-understand style. Speak directly to your readers using you and we to make the information more personal and relevant. Write in the active voice, not the passive voice, and use simple verb tenses. Step 4. Organize your writing. Put the most important information first. Use a consistent layout and incorporate simple formats. Use descriptive titles and headings that include the keywords your readers are searching for, so search engines can find your content. Include white space in your design to break up blocks of text and avoid the wall of words effect. Step 5. Monitor your writing. If someone can't understand the text the first time they read it, it's not written in plain language. Get feedback from peers and customers, then fix mistakes and make improvements. Step 6. Everyone from the top down should learn to use plain language. Encourage your staff to attend training through Web Manager University and consider bringing in a plain language expert to train your team. Improve your site with clear, concise, and well-organized writing to help search engines find your content, ensure people get quick answers, and reduce help desk questions. Plain and simple. Did you know? The U.S. government supports plain language. Soon, plain language may become the standard style for all government documents issued to the public. For more information, go to webcontent.gov.
So I meant before I started the video to caveat it with the statement that this was a video developed for government agencies around plain language. And it's particularly on websites. But I wanted to show it to you because, the fundamental lessons and information in there pertain to when you're developing informed consent forms. So things that they mentioned, like, the wall of words, very, very relevant. Some things that they didn't mention were because they're less relevant on websites and it's different. Is using a large font size. So we recommend a minimum of 14 point Times Roman or the equivalent, and using short lines. So like a newspaper, it is harder to read across a whole long page, and people can read more easily if it's short, and if it's less left justified. We're very often we center text, or we, you know, even right justify it, very, very much harder to read. Or you know, justifying it on both sides is harder to read than if it's left justified. So this is just an example. Colleague Chris Trudeau from the Center for Health Literacy took an informed consent form and applied on the left and applied some of the health literacy strategies to it on the right. So you can see how the information is chunked out, how there are headings, there's use of bolding to attract your attention to certain places so that you can see how it looks different. And how the right one, the right-hand side one, it is more inviting and less intimidating. So one of the areas of pushback, you know, you might be thinking is, well, but won't it be so long? And yes, we do want to keep documents short. Keeping it to the need-to-know information, removing information that isn't necessary, that's distracting. We can be direct and shorten things by saying, you know, the first person, we, talking about you. But sometimes being clear takes more words. You know, sometimes the jargon is shorthand for things that it's going to take more words to explain clearly. And I think that we sometimes say, oh, you know, I want it to fit on one page or two pages, or we get sort of obsessed with, you know, the length, that we cram things in and make it harder, when people would actually prefer a longer document that they can easily read rather than these dense, short ones. So with that, I'm pleased that I was able to get through an awful lot of information and leave plenty of time for answering questions and discussion. So I stop the screen sharing and I'm going to open up the Q&A. And I'm going to be very embarrassed if you don't ask questions or make comments, because it means I haven't effectively communicated my desire to hear from you. So what would you like to know more about? Thanks, Regina. Let's hear it lightly. There's got to be something that I didn't talk about or that I wasn't clear about. And you run the risk of my asking you questions too. What about, you know, what is there anything that you heard today that you're going to now take back to your hospital? Say, oh God, yeah, this is going to be helpful. What's the you know, one or two most important things you heard today? Value of listening to patients. So, Regina, thank you very much for mentioning that, because we actually have a new tool at ARC, which I didn't include in this. It's actually a toolkit on diagnostic safety. And what the research indicates is actually the best thing that you can do for diagnostic safety is listen to your patients and families. And so we have this toolkit, and it has a provider-facing tool and a patient-facing tool. So the provider tool is to say, you know, give them 60 seconds without interrupting, because the research shows that I think it's like 11 to 17 seconds the patient talks before they get cut off. So giving them that, just that 1 minute to really listen, can, you know, get important parts of the story that might save a lot of money in terms of diagnostic testing, or, you know, going down the wrong road with the diagnostic and diagnosis and treatment. And then there's a patient facing tool about telling your story, because we don't all come equipped, especially when we're feeling sick and scared, et cetera, with being able to be ready to share the story and talk about it. So those are some other tools that are available. Hearing people repeat back in their own words. So that is teach back. I call this the rock star or poster child for health literacy. If I had to choose one strategy, I would talk about that. But I caution, I know that it's used in the leapfrog standard, but I don't like to say repeat, because repeat makes it sound like you're using exactly the same words as the person who's explaining things to you, and it needs to be in their own words, because otherwise you get the parrot syndrome. But yes, hugely important. Can I talk about digital consent? People consenting by clicking on an iPad. So I know that that is increasing in its popularity. I am not an expert in this. I am concerned that, if people, you haven't had a discussion if you're just getting an iPad and you click consent. If you've had a discussion, if you've talked to somebody and you're confident that they understood, then I see, and there's somebody who could help somebody who doesn't know how to use an iPad. I haven't mentioned digital literacy, but that is yet another kind of skill that comes into play once you start introducing the digital tools. There's another kind of digital consent that I kind of like, which is where it's almost like incorporating decision aids and information and multimedia so that people have other ways of understanding. There are some things that can be taught through those kinds of modalities, and yet you still have to have the conversation, the teach back to make sure that the information is understood. Someone mentioned about having the interpreter speak up. And there are other strategies in that limited English proficiency team steps module, things like briefing the interpreter before you go in, on what the patient's situation is, using structured communication so that there's something called cuss words, where you sort of caution that you think there's an issue. You say, "I'm uncomfortable." You say, "Stop, I think that there's a patient safety issue," that you sort of to escalate it, because we have to empower people because we're not used to interpreters or other health professionals kind of saying, I don't think that the patient's understanding this is not safe. The guided questions. I seem to get complaints from patients after procedures that they didn't understand it ahead of time. Absolutely. I'm glad those are helpful. That's all in the training modules. So a good plug for using those with your at your hospital. How can family get involved? Generally, we don't have medical. One issue in informed consent is, of course, competence. Is the person competent to consent? And if somebody is in a situation where somebody else has to be doing the consenting for them, whether or not they have a medical power of attorney, that's one case. But whether it's an elderly parent or a spouse or a sibling there are people that are very important. So if you weren't on my earlier leapfrog presentation, I talked about my father, and he was in the hospital and they thought he had a stroke and they were gonna take him off to give him TPA. And I said, "Hold on." And one of the things that wasted our time was they hadn't really informed me what was going on when they were doing a CT scan. And they didn't ask me, you know, is there somebody else that you want to talk to about this decision? So then all of a sudden they were still saying he should have this medicine. And I wanted to talk to my mother, his wife, you know, and no, you know, somebody could have said at the beginning, saying, is there anyone else who should be involved in this decision? You know, that to me is a key early question that you wanna ask, so that you're not gonna explain it all to one person, then you say, oh, I have to talk to my sister. You know. So great question. Okay, so we have a question about sort of verifying the quality of interpreter services that are provided by vendors. And I was actually just in a conversation where this morning, where somebody was saying, you know, we've had instances where our clinicians are using plain language, but our interpreters think that that's not respectful, and so they use much more formal language and actually make it harder to understand. And that's why it's so important. So yes, you can't, if you're using a vendor, you can't, like, we recommend training the professional staff and the interpreters together on that Team Steps training. But I also know of hospitals that have gotten their third-party vendors to get trained and to do health literacy training. And one hospital that was on this call this morning was saying how they had their interpreters trained in TeachVac. So they understood, you know. So yeah, it's a little more complicated, but there are definitely ways of addressing it. And I'm just reading this last question. So this is a question about somebody who sort of says, oh no, I speak English. And actually in the Team Steps, we have a video of exactly that, of, you know, a patient saying, oh no, I speak English, and the doctor proceeding and a nurse intervening and saying, no, I think we need to get an interpreter. And the doctor says, well, no, he just said he speaks English. He said, no, you know. And so one really important thing is hospital policy. So if you feel that patient may not be understanding whether or not they say they want an interpreter, you should be calling an interpreter. It's for your own protection, your hospital's protection. And they might say, I want my sister to interpret, even though we know untrained interpreters are more likely to make clinically significant errors. So you say, great, you can have your sister interpret for you, but I have to have a hospital interpreter. And so then you have somebody present who can check if there's a miscommunication along the way. Now, somebody who, you know, insists that they're not going to, you know, talk through, insist on speaking English, you know, having the interpreter present might, you know, help provide some cultural brokering. But you know, you can't force somebody to not speak English. And it's important to document that. But I think that if you explain that, you know, you just want to make sure that you're being clear, it's not you, it's not your English peers, but I'm not confident, I need an interpreter, some kind of thing. Great comments and questions. What else do you want to know? All right, Jean-Luc, I think I've worn them out.
Fair enough. Well, I mean, we do have 5 minutes left. I don't know if anyone has any questions, you know, specific to
leapfrog. Oh, you know what I do want? I want you to tell everybody how they get the slides and the resources, because last time we had a lot of questions about that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So on Leapfrog's Town Hall Calls webpage right there on the website, you'll be able to see the recording and slides and so on. So this will actually be it maybe even that you signed up directly from the website. So it would just be the same sort of homepage that hosts those and that has hosted all those in the past. Actually the same place you'd find the webinar series and also.
All right. Well, I actually am a believer in leaving a little break between meetings. So I'm going to call it because everybody should get up and stretch. Oh, it looks like there's one more comment or question. I think maybe. No, I went from 10 to 11, but I don't see a new one. Did I miss any?
Yeah, here I can read it. The tips you provided today should be applied in all patient interactions, especially during the initial patient assessment and prior to procedures. Have you developed any tools which improve information on social determinants of health?
Yes. So if you go to, I'm going to type website. So we have a social determinants of health section of ARC's website, and there are various tools that have been used to assess social determinants of health. This is a huge thing that we all are starting to grapple with, even though it's been an issue for decades. And I guess my parting shot will be, if you plan to assess people, you need to have a plan of what you're going to do with that information. And I do know sometimes people feel like, oh, we should be collecting this. And then it's like, okay, now what? So, do you have referrals and systems in place to help people get to organizations that can address some of their social needs? Do you have resources that you could give, such as patient navigators or other kinds of resources that could help them with some of those issues? So it is a critical thing that we know, healthcare only contributes a small percentage, and I'm using a vague term, let's say 15%, to overall health status. And so all of these other things outside of our healthcare system are affecting people. And you can't take care of your diabetes if you don't have healthy food, and all of those things that I think people know. Actually, that reminds me, there's also a new effort that I learned about called Food is Medicine, and the idea of prescribing food. And if you Google Food is Medicine, you can probably find some more information about that. Lots of work to do. All right. Well, thank you for having me again. I'm going to continue working with Leapfrog as they do their improvement work around their standards, hope that you will find many of these tools useful in your own journey.
Have a great Absolutely. Day. Thank you so much, Cindy. All right, take care, everyone. We'll end it here.